Welcome to series two of Greater Than 11%. I can't actually believe I'm saying those words, series two. What started out as a small idea has grown into a focused and ongoing compulsion to push for change. And I'm pleased to say we've expanded. There's been some changes to the format and who's involved. I'll still be interviewing awesome women about their roles and creative careers, but at the beginning of every month, we will be facilitating a roundup of industry news, what's inspiring us and what isn't, with my fabulous co-host, Crystal Eisinger. We'll also be joined by a special guest each month who will pitch into the discussion. Our wonderful Series 1 producer, Patrick Murray, has moved on to pastures anew. And former guest and host of Greater Than 11%, Ursie Downs, has stepped into the role. She will also be doubling up as a host in the near future. We've had a bumpy couple of months. We had sponsorship. We didn't have sponsorship. We had sponsorship. And at this point, we don't have any sponsorship. But we're hopeful. So any brands or philanthropic donors out there who would like to support us on our mission to promote creative roles and awesome women, please do get in touch. So, Crystal, lots of discussions and planning, and here we are kicking off series two.
Here we are. The day has come.
It has.
I'm delighted. So much to talk about. So, shall we go into it?
Let's go.
So, favourite perspective from the last few Greater Than 11% podcasts and why? It's like having to choose your favourite child.
Well, I think the last interview I did was with Hannah Kendall, a composer. And what was amazing about that interview was that I was so excited, like uber excited, to be interviewing a composer. Lots of people had requested to speak to a composer. And Hannah came on and I had this like magical notion that she had some like extraordinary talent that I just couldn't kind of understand because it wasn't a language I spoke, music. And she was pretty realistic about the challenges and how difficult the role was and actually how much frustration she would incur on a daily basis just living out that role of making music and writing music.
Yeah, definitely. She de-romanticized it in a very good and real way. I loved when she talked about drawing out the shape of music. It made me think about whether people who are slightly put off by the idea of music because of the focus solely on hearing and sound might have a different entry point in through her way of visualizing it.
Yeah, definitely. And she also talked about that there's actually some composers that actually don't write music. They actually visualize it and then work with someone who writes music. And that was like a completely new notion to me. It kind of makes me feel like I could be a composer.
You could be a composer. You can do anything you want to do. But don't you think it would be quite transformational if they taught music in that way at school? Because I think there's something quite, well, personally found reading music quite confusing and actually visualizing it in that way rather than having to read music in the traditional way it's taught may have, could have been the next Mozart.
But I also think like education, and I won't go down that rant on that because I could really go down a rabbit hole here, but it's very linear in terms of the way it's taught and actually thinking about different ways of teaching, like thinking about visualization of music, especially people who are neurodiverse, you know, that's actually a really poignant way to think about creating, reading, understanding, and composing something that's based on sound.
Yeah, totally. On your topic of education, another thing that I loved about her episode was how she talked about the underlying self-confidence that she had through her qualifications in education. And I think for some people it will be their qualifications in education, but it's always a really valuable exercise to do the what would the napkin in the back of your pocket say before you go and do a speech or if you go and do something scary. They always advise that you write down what those three or four key achievements, for some people be their education, for somebody else it might be something that they've done or a different type of achievement, as a little boost before you go into everything. And I thought that was really powerful, and it made me reflect. Sometimes reading your CV can be the best thing, and like looking at those kind of key formalized milestones can be a really powerful thing when you're having a bit of a self-confidence crisis.
Yeah, I've never heard that actually. I think that's especially from someone who doesn't quite like public speaking so much, actually writing down achievements and putting them in your pocket. I never have pockets, so maybe my shoulder pad.
On a brooch.
It's a great idea actually. I really love that.
Yeah. Sophie Thomas also I thought was absolutely incredible, particularly because every time you gave her a compliment, she reiterated how collaborative her work was. And I think it's such a wonderful thing when people really own the fact that the end result is never solely a result of their own work. It's the result of all the hands that have touched it. And I like that she was so open about that in the podcast with you.
Sophie, I think, is incredible as a costume and set designer, and like the skill range that she has to be able to pull together sets, costumes, and have that language. And also, she was really open about saying this: sometimes you're not the most talented person in the room in relation to one element of putting a set and costumes together, and actually handing that over and relinquishing that control and allowing that person to really develop it and allow them the space, which is really difficult when you're having to oversee things and everything will come back to, well, that was the designer. And I think she had a really beautiful understanding of the role and her role and the generosity to allow other people to shine.
And both episodes brought up that idea of relinquishing control in different ways, which I thought was interesting. I think my favourite phrase from Sophie's episode, which had a lot of amazing phrases in it, including emotional alchemy, was being a visual data pirate. She talked about that, how she would catalogue using Pinterest and tech to keep feeding her imagination almost as a back catalogue for future projects that she's working on. And I thought that was a really brilliant idea and something that I would actually like to invest a bit more time in. It doesn't have to be visual, I guess it could be quotes or ideas or things that you like. I loved the systematic way in which she did that, because it would be easy to say, oh, it's she's creative and she'll just have this idea, we'll be walking on a park and something will strike her. But actually it was very deliberate, the way in which she went about getting her inspiration. I loved that.
Yeah, she's definitely a magpie, organized magpie.
Yeah. I think especially at a time where in a lot of organizations at the moment, it's performance time, performance reviews, and something that she said was, the value someone puts on you with your paycheck is not your worth. And I thought that was fantastic. And it's a really useful leadership lesson as well, which is you're not defined by your paycheck. You're not defined by the arbitrary rating that you're given once every 6 months or once every 12 months. And that's why it's so important to have that village to keep you mentally healthy, another thing that she said. And also hedge yourself a little bit against work or against those things that could define your self-worth by investing in the side hustles, investing in your friends or family or community to make sure that you're kind of emotionally and mentally fit.
I think that's a tricky thing to do. And I think Sophie was very, again, generous in the openness that she brought to the podcast, because that was definitely a process for her. And I think many of us can identify with that, in that, you know, what you do for your job and then what you earn can sometimes be so disconnected. And actually we can focus on the value placed on what we take home each week or month as being our worth. And actually, yeah, I don't think anyone could articulate it better than Sophie. It's such a great episode for really thinking about how we look at ourselves and how we look at what we do, our creative element, and then also where we place ourselves within work life and within culture.
And how, what you need to survive on a very practical level. You know, she talked about moving to London, how much money she needed to pay her rent in London and live. And actually, then she made the decision not to be in London after that. And both of the episodes, actually, Sophie's and Hannah's, I thought were incredibly raw and gave a really unromantic but amazing view on each of their crafts, which I thought was incredibly refreshing. Is there any perspective that's really stayed with you?
So, Sadish Paul, I am absolutely in love with. I think she is an incredible woman. And meeting her and having that interview, it really, I don't know, blew something open in me in terms of her real kind of determination in relation to using her creativity in addition to her role. And we talk about side hustles and doing things on the side and doing the extra things. I mean, she is living and breathing it, and she has done for forever, like her whole career. And she has a really busy day job and a very serious, weighty day job that has emotional kind of labor and taxing to it. And then she's off using her creativity and rinsing every minute again to help and to make change. And I just found her so inspirational, and I often think about her and I just feel so incredibly, I don't know, powered up by her. She has that incredible ability to also make you feel like you can make change just by having a conversation with her. I'd quite happily travel to Birmingham once a week and have an interview or a chat with her. I just was blown away by that kind of time I had with her.
Can I make a guilty confession?
Hmm.
Both yours and her episodes I found quite exhausting in great ways, but as you said, everything that she talked about was how she absolutely wrung every minute out of every day. She had her brilliant ideas on a Sunday when watching TV with the kids, although I imagine she was also building new board games during that process as well. And there's a little voice in my head that's like, oh, when I'm sitting at home ordering my Nando's and watching Netflix, like, should I be creating board games that save the world or amazing podcasts or doing other things? And I wonder, I know that's not a very helpful reaction to it, but I'm also like, how do all these people have all this energy and do this all the time? I don't know whether anyone else thinks that, that just makes me sound like a bad person, but...
I sit at home and watch Netflix, I'm telling you that. I don't want a Nando's vegetarian. Do they do vegetarian stuff, Nando's?
Yes. Okay. Resounding nod from our producer in the corner.
Well, I'm sorry that you feel exhausted, but you shouldn't. When you're watching Netflix, it's downtime, but it's also time to think about things, which I'm sure you've got things whirring away in the back of your mind.
Mm.
Amazing strategies or lectures you're developing. And I just think, like, everyone finds their level, you know, in terms of what they're happy to do, what they want to do. And it's not that some people do more and other people bad for doing less.
No, thank you. I don't need you to be sorry for me. It didn't make me feel exhausted. Exhausted is the wrong word. But I also do think that within this incredible world of personal development and being curious and thinking about this kind of thing, there is a flip side to it, which is a slight element of guilt, if I'm completely honest, around how could I be better using this time? And there are some brilliant Instagram posts on this, so I'm sure I won't do it justice. But at what episode does self-care go too far and venture into laziness versus self-care? Because I agree, like, it's really important to do those things to have the downtime. Mm. But then also, is that a millennial thing? You know, do people, because my parents never had downtime, they were just out working the whole time.
So your parents never watched Corrie or EastEnders or
my
some
dad
other
did.
Terrible soap?
My dad did, but this is like a therapy session, but I think the underlying belief is like any minute that you're not spent doing something work-related or furthering your curiosity or feeding your mind in some way is almost wasted time. But... and maybe that's the thing that it triggers within me, is thinking, oh my God, Renee and Sadisha are so amazing. They're using their time so brilliantly to do such amazing things. And I'm here on my 9th chicken wing.
I think your perspective's warped, because I definitely need downtime. And I know that I need to power down so that I can power back up. But I don't talk about those times, you know, when I get home and it's like 8:30 and I just like stare at Netflix and try to watch the most trashiest thing so that my brain can switch off. And I need that. And I've got into a routine of knowing when that is needed. Mm. So please keep eating your chicken wings or adapt and eat something vegan. But and keep watching Netflix.
Thanks, I will.
Laziness is good. I don't know why is laziness bad. I don't understand this notion.
I don't think it's bad. I actually think it's useful to talk about on a podcast which is full of so many brilliant people doing so many wonderful things. It's in the same way that I think it's really easy to look at people's social media accounts and just think that they're constantly going to the gym or being on holiday or going to glamorous events. I'm basically describing myself right now. But then actually I often think, okay, I also need to post about the times where I'm feeling terrible, I'm exhausted, I'm ill, I'm not feeling great, because otherwise you can give people a warped perception of like what life is actually like, which is why I think our listeners will be very happy to hear that you sit and watch Netflix surrounded by your Scoobies, so, you know.
I'm even going to talk about that. Scoobies.
Anything else we'd like to talk about in terms of previous Grace 11% guests?
In terms of series one, I just can't believe how amazing it was to interview 52 incredible, incredible women, on top of meeting people at Creative Equals and interviewing loads of people there as well. And it has blown me away, one, at kind of the amazing journeys people have, but also and I've talked about this in the podcast before, that opportunity for people to talk about their journey and what they've done, and actually seeing people really enjoy that process, even though they might have been a bit scared at first. And I think that has been something that really has inspired me and made me want to kind of continue, you know, with the podcast and other things, which we'll talk about in a bit. But that's the takeaway for me, that actually creating space for everyone, not just those at the top of the game. I think that's really vital.
So let's talk about some work that we love this month.
Yeah, sounds good.
So every month we thought we would bring the outside in and have a bit of a curiosity corner on the things that we love, the things that made us stop and think from the creative industry. Something that you sent over, which I thought was very interesting, was the Procter & Gamble commitment around 100% women made music in ads for a secret brand. What did you love about that?
So what I love about this is, and I found this on The Drum, this article, that P&G are committing to this 100% of women-made music for ads for Secrets, which is deodorant. What they're doing is they've kind of got a campaign that they're pushing out via Instagram, where they're searching and hiring for 250 aspiring female singers and songwriters and producers kind of within music. And I just think that is so, so awesome. Their whole focus is partnering the 250 hopefuls with women that are already within the music industry, and then providing kind of mentorship and guidance and helping them develop their skills. So that's completely like my kind of whole value and ethos. It's kind of around the podcast as well, is this notion of helping each other, skilling up, swapping skills, developing and kind of campaigning for each other. And I just think brands need to be doing this more and more. You know, it's a deodorant for women. It's being, well, the music's being made by women for the product, who are going to buy the product. And this should be happening more and more. I don't know why it's not, actually. And I just think it's a brilliant kind of take. And it seems really straightforward. It doesn't seem like a difficult thing to do. So yeah, a big nod, little salute to P&G. I think that's a brilliant campaign.
The part of it that really resonated with me is that a core part of your favorite word, authenticity, is coherence, right? The coherence with which you apply that across everything that you do. And the thing that I love about this and the way that the industry is moving towards is that committing to particular causes, being purpose-led, needs to exist the whole way through the supply chain. And another great thing that I heard yesterday was, if you measure it, you treasure it. So I think the more that we can put targets behind this in terms of the type of organizations that we work with, from music to production to copywriting, the better output that we'll get, because more diversity leads to better work, better creative.
For sure. And also speaking to those audiences that are going to buy the product, for God's sakes. You know, like, I am still baffled why this hasn't been happening sooner and at a quicker rate. But, you know, great that it's happening.
Another wonderful thing from The Drum, which the wonderful Ursie Dan sent on, was the Women's Equality Party series of ads, which I loved. The reason I loved it is because, well, A, the guy looks like Nigel Farage in all of the photos, but B, it delivers a really serious message in a really grotesquely beautiful way. The copy is, you know, when one in five workers in Westminster are being sexually harassed, how's anything going to change? And I was actually really shocked rereading those statistics. It made me feel quite disgusted, actually. And it also made me have so much respect for all women politicians and the inherent institutional adversity that they face through being there, regardless of what party they're on.
I think for anyone that hasn't seen the campaign, it's kind of a photo kind of series of lookalike greasy politicians. You're right, I think they're taking a big dig at Nigel Farage, because it did look very similar to him, holding up kind of like a handwritten kind of notes with these kind of statements on them. And I think in that case as well, it's not just women. I imagine that minority parties within politics probably suffer same levels of abuse as well. And I think calling it out is a great thing. I'd be interested to know where that campaign is going, because I thought they were visually arresting. They stop you in your tracks. They make you think. But what's going to happen as a result of this campaign? I couldn't kind of see where the measurement was, apart from maybe just drawing attention to some slimy, very arrogant, very kind of patriarchal focused.
Yeah, men. You're right. I think it's minority parties, minority groups in general, totally. And yeah, you're right. There's The thing that's amazing about them is they look almost like Christmas or birthday cards, and I wonder what the activation is going to be. But maybe we should just buy lots of them and send them as Christmas cards to our friends in Westminster. The thing that was really haunting about it, though, is that it kept reinforcing the terrible acts that had happened and that people were still keeping their job. It feels very out of sync with where corporate culture is moving to, which is a lot, I feel, increasingly accountable, where that kind of behaviour is not tolerated and that the institution that is responsible for so much important decision making is still not moving quickly on that. The underlying belief within that is that there's a lack of great talent who could fill those roles were those people not there, which we know not to be the case because there are so many brilliant people in the civil service and in politics in general, and you almost want these green shoots to be able to come up. Yet they're being capped by people who have done terrible things.
Yeah, well, that's nothing new for me. That, I mean, that's just, I've said it before, it's an old boys network protecting an old boys network. And, you know, without getting too political here, you know, let's just look at our Prime Minister at present. You know, some of the things that have happened, I mean, just look at the American president, some of the things that have happened pre his watch, on his watch, same with Boris, you know, that wouldn't exist, you know, it wouldn't happen elsewhere to a degree, because I think corporate culture's still got a long way to go.
Yeah, I think it's a great question that you ask, which is where is the Women's Equality Party going to take that? Because I think it's a brilliant starting point in raising awareness around it. And when you first read it, it feels unbelievable. 1 in 5, 20% of workers in Westminster are being sexually harassed.
It feels unbelievable, but it doesn't. I'm not shocked by those. But I think that's the problem, is I'm not shocked by it, so where do I go with it?
Yeah. And how will it change the way that people start to do things? Maybe we should ask our listeners whether they're shocked or not shocked by it.
Yeah, that would be a good Instagram poll. Maybe we should do that, because I am curious to see where it would go. And like, I think the Women's Equality Party is fantastic, and it's great, that movement that's starting to happen. It needs a lot more momentum behind it, for sure. Because I think also people's awareness of the Women's Equality Party, I imagine, is quite low. And maybe it was just an awareness piece, because it is very eye-catching and it is really in your face.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it has a lot of airtime within particular parts of society. But I also imagine a lot of people wouldn't think that it was a real thing, or who it was associated with. It wasn't a legitimate party in any way. But obviously they are standing and doing a lot of campaigning to end violence against women and make sure that women are a political priority. And it'll be very interesting to see where they take it next.
Well, yeah, by the next time we catch up on our panel, we will have had an election. So let's see what that outcome is.
On a slight side note, can I tell you about my really, really intense experience this morning on the tube?
Please, I love a side note. Okay. I love intense experiences.
Okay, great. So, on the way to my lecture this morning, very early, I was really tired as it was, and anyway, trundled onto the tube, onto the Central Line, sat down, I was preparing my speech because I was hosting Renee for this Marketing Academy lecture.
Not me.
Not you. I would have loved to have hosted you this morning. I was thinking about you this morning, I'm chatting to you now, it was a different Renee. Anyway, I was on my way there, preparing my introduction. Also closed my eyes to trying to do meditation. Anyway, then I got off at St. Paul's and my bum and legs were like all really wet, like sopping wet. And because I felt really cold all of a sudden, I was like, oh, why am I so cold? This is horrible. And then I kind of felt around and I was like, oh gosh, like my whole bum is wet. And it was really early and I was already in a really bad mood. And I've just spent the whole day thinking about what that liquid was on the tube seat. And people have been really nice and tried to reassure me that maybe it was like bleach or cleaning fluid or something. But the reality is that it was probably someone's piss. And then, because I was introducing the other Renee, I was then like Dysoning my ass in the toilets as all these people were coming in the morning. And obviously now I just have dried wee on my trousers, and it was just the worst way to start my day ever. And I just really needed to share that with somebody.
Well, it's not obvious it is wee. I mean, highly likely, but not obvious. It could have been a pint, because people do drink on the tube still.
But in the morning, is there a 24-hour tube not during the week? No, Ursie shaking her head. That means no. So we can eliminate alcohol because Boris Johnson made it illegal to drink on public transport.
I know, but people still do.
Do they? I don't know.
Pat's saying he does. Ursie does.
Incriminating.
I don't think I drink on TFL, but I will drink on a train.
Okay. Because you're fancy. Oh my God, you're so classy. Also, you can totally be the next viral woman drinking her, was it pink gin tonic, out of a proper glass on the tube. Yes. Definitely.
Well, Diane Abbott was drinking her mojito on the tube. I mean, if that isn't a fuck you, Boris, what isn't?
Back to the story. It probably wasn't alcohol. The best thing that I heard today was someone told me that at least we are sterile and at least it wasn't shit. That's true.
I mean, shit would be a lot worse.
Yeah, but I obviously wouldn't have sat in it if there was shit on the seat.
Well, you say obviously. You're in a bad mood. It was early.
Actually, and also, I forgot to show you the crucial part. The first thing that I thought was when I was having my few moments of meditation, I was like, did I piss myself when I when I was sleeping?
What I love is, one, you've been dressed, but you're meant to clear your mind, and all you're doing is focusing on your meditation. Did you piss yourself?
Maybe I was so relaxed. That was my thought. I was like, was I so relaxed? Because you know when it's really early and you're tired and my eyes were streaming from meditating because my eyes were closed. And I was like, maybe I was just so relaxed that I pissed myself. But I didn't. And I'm just, it was not a great way to start the day. And I just really needed to offload that. So of all the seats on the Central Line, I had to sit on one which was soaked with a nondescript, probably bodily fluid of some sort, and that's made me sad, but hey.
But what's the best thing that's come out of that?
I mean, my underwear is soaked in someone else's piss, like there's not a huge amount of upside. The best thing that can come out from that is I talked about it when I introduced Renee, the other Renee, because I was really distraught about it, because it was quite soon after that had happened. Actually, the great thing that happened from that was there was a very nice lady who walked into the toilet while I was easing myself above the Dyson hand dryer, and she was very kind to me and reassured me in the morning. So that was a nice moment of kindness out of a moment of piss bear. Let's move on. Something I'd like to ask you about. You talked in your introduction about how you had sponsorship, you don't have sponsorship, still don't have sponsorship. How have you found that over the last few weeks?
So it's been really up and down, and I have had moments where I've been kind of, not despair, but I'm really focused on pushing the podcast forward, and as a collective as well, so yourself and Ursi, and it's not exactly how we planned it at this point in time, which is a little bit disappointing, and it's kind of something I'm kind of struggling with at the moment. But I really do believe it's going to find its pathway, and there's been a lot of change for me anyway in the last couple of months. I am no longer Hub's chief creative officer, and I'm currently freelancing, and I'm also teaching one day a week, and I've got like super big plans for grade 11% as a whole. So at the start of every month we'll be doing the panel, but also kind of around that time I'll also be hosting an event each month. Got a fantastic space already secured with an amazing brand called Minotti, and I'm really excited about that. So around the 5th of January we'll have our first event, so there'll be more kind of on our social channels about that. And also in the early stages of developing a quarterly magazine and a kind of platform which kind of feeds off the back of the zine, and I've had a lot of positive kind of response from that, either from brands or kind of circulation, all in kind of different kind of areas, so from the arts through to potentially magazine shops and things like that. So lots and lots is going on. So the knocks of not getting the sponsorship, and that's really hard. Like, we had one sponsor come on and then another sponsor come on, and it was just like, oh my God, this is so great. And it's so great when people believe in you. And then one of the sponsors dropped out, and quite quickly the other sponsor dropped out. And then I get it, commerciality, and people are in different places at different points. But I think it's hard when you have something and then it's taken away. And that happened like 2 weeks ago. And it's been, yeah, a bit of a tough one, but I also really believe that we're on that path to finding sponsorship, and it will happen. It's just a process, but I'm totally committed to keep doing the podcast. I want to keep promoting and shouting about awesome women. I want to keep pushing for change, and I really want to measure and treasure that statistic going up and up and up.
Amazing. And I think you've spoken so much about your core values and why you're doing what you're doing. And I wonder whether that keeps the confidence, keeps the faith a little bit, because you know you'll get to that direction. It's just the how. You know, it's the why, not the how. And I find that really powerful, because you never come across as flustered or disheartened. You have so much energy. I actually feel quite exhausted just hearing about all the amazing things that you're doing in a positive way. Positive exhaustion. Good. Is good. That a thing?
Yeah. I hope that it just transfers. Like, I can flick some over.
I've already had enough stuff flicked on me today, Renee.
No, you bathed in the piss. I'm flicking positivity to you.
Catching it. It's interesting, actually, when I was in the process of taking on my new role, I was told that I had the new role, and then some stuff happened, and it was like, oh no, not just yet, can't tell people about it, might not happen. And in those moments, it's almost worse that you found out about it and you allowed yourself to be happy for a moment, because you're like, damn it, I shouldn't have had that celebratory glass of champagne until I'd signed, because it's not just quite there yet. But yeah, things find their path in the end. But I really admire the way that you maintain such incredible poise and positivity and purpose.
So we caught up back in, I think, May time for your interview. Is that correct?
I don't know.
When did you get married?
July.
Okay, so we caught up in June, because it was just before you went and got married.
Okay, I believe you.
Yeah, no, that's definitely the case. And so in between that time, you've changed roles as well, and you got married. So what have you been up to the last month or so since the summer?
So lots of changes happened in the last few weeks. I've, as you said, taken on a new role. I am officially in marketing now, which is a big win. And yeah, I'm getting used to the new role. I love the new team that I'm in. Also going through that new job phase of being absolutely exhausted. I'm listening, immersing myself in so many brilliant resources, Greater Than 11% podcast being one of those, but also a lot of other stuff around leadership and personal development. And I'm consistently failing to apply any of the things that I know to be the things that I should be doing. I keep referencing him, but the other Renee in my life this morning had some brilliant nuggets that I'm really going to think about how I can apply. He said that managers write strategies and leaders tell stories. And I love that. And I've been really questioning myself over the last day, because I only heard it this morning, thinking like, why am I not telling stories? Why am I not storytelling? And where I've got to with it is that I'm not being very creative. And the reason I'm not being very creative is because I feel like I don't have energy or time. I'm constantly doing stuff, and the thing that gives me most energy is being creative, which would then feed that storytelling bit. So I'm doing all the things wrong. You know, I'm managing my time and not my energy, and doing none of the things that the Squiggly Careers podcast tells you to or anything else. And I guess the first step in changing it is acknowledging, perhaps. So I definitely need to keep feeding my creative side and curiosity side and bring that into the work that I'm doing, because at the moment I'm just trying to get to grips with stuff and very much feel like I'm just surviving as opposed to thriving, I guess. And also, though, I feel like I can be quite honest and liberated with it. I have a great new manager, and I think that you have to acknowledge the times where you're winning awards and doing really great things, with the times where it's hard, where you're finding your feet, when you're on that really sharp edge of the kind of the S-curve. And, you know, it's easy to forget, especially when you move internally, I think, because you're still going to the same place every day. You're not almost in that mindset of, I've got a new job and I need to fully commit to that. And so now I'm very much at the stage where kind of 80% is unfamiliar, uncomfortable, new, and 20, actually probably more than that, I would say like 95% of it, and trying to establish myself and be a great leader. And as I said, don't feel like I'm doing any of those things particularly well right now, but trying to get the longer view, think about how I can tell stories rather than write strategy.
And change is difficult. Like, even if you're open to change, it's changing your mindset. Like you're saying, you're in the same company, but you're in a different team, in a different desk. You know, you're learning new things. Can't be too tough on yourself. Got to allow yourself that change transition, which is exhausting. I think people forget that. Change is tiring because we're reprogramming, learning new things, taking on new information.
Yeah, totally. I heard something today which was the career life cycle has changed so much that 10 years ago, every 10 years a company would regenerate itself, and now that time period, that company life cycle is 18 months. And so it's like Love Island time, basically. So if you've been in a job for 3 years, it's the equivalent of 30 years, for example. And I was chatting to someone earlier who was saying, you should really change your context. The thing that people ask when they see that you've been at a company for over 3 years or 4 years is, can we unlearn them? Can we unteach them what they know? I thought that was a really interesting way of looking at tenure in a world where it's very easy to be, oh, they've been at that place for 10 years. That must mean that they're very senior or very good at what they do. So I found that quite a refreshing perspective, even though there was a bit of me which was like, well, I've done 3 different roles in those 4 years. Like, don't judge me. But actually, it was a really interesting thing to hear. And even though you can think like, oh, yeah, I'm happy to move around, happy to do something different, you're like, are you? Because 4 years is actually quite a long time, even if you feel like you're doing something new. So, yes, change and transitions do take energy, and definitely have not afforded myself the same kind of kindness and generosity that I perhaps would if I was physically going to another building. But as I said, I'm excited about what's to come, and I'm trying to anchor it in what are my spikes, what are my super strengths, and how can I apply them more. And if I think about my last few days and weeks, I'm probably doing stuff that is energy draining all the time. So I need to find a way to carve out time to do some of those things that I love that give me energy. Someone said, when I was chatting to them, my brilliant colleague Lucy, she said, oh, but I was listening to your greater than 11%. This is the stuff that you love. Why don't you do that? And I was like, oh yeah, maybe I should do a bit of that, because that will give me energy.
So we're galloping towards the end of the year, which means that we're currently sitting in a period of time quite impactful on women in a really negative way. So this is something you raised earlier.
You're talking about the run-up to Christmas?
There's that as well. We're not. There is that as well, actually.
Indeed. In fact, am I allowed to say that today, the day of recording this podcast, is the day at which women basically work for free for the rest of the year?
Yes.
And something that we were talking about was, is that something that people find discouraging? What emotion does that stimulate in you? Is it apathy? Is it anger? Is it energy?
So I counted the days, that official date of the 14th of November, 47 bloody days of no pay. That infuriates me. It's actually unbelievable. And I find it really frustrating. I can understand how people's bias can come in to play in interviews, and how people might hire people that are similar to them in terms of kind of cultural fit or background or familial connections. What I cannot understand is how you can have a role and actually the pay discrepancy is based on gender. That makes no fucking sense on any level. Like, a role is a role. And I think it's obvious, so I get really angered by this. I was listening to an interview on Radio 4 on Women's Hour, and they were talking to women who have actually been going through tribunal in relation to kind of pay discrepancies. And this one woman, she worked in a kitchen within a school. It was a big company. They had many contracts with many schools, and she'd been in this company for 10 years. And she found out by accident when her male colleague, who had been in the position for 18 months and was at an equal level as her, she discovered that he was getting paid $6,000 more a year than her. $6,000. We're not talking like a couple hundred quid here. Not that I'm saying that's acceptable, but that's a sizable difference for the same role for someone who's been in that role for 10 years, and she had way more experience and skills than him. And she went to her manager, and her manager said, well, that's just the way it is. So she took them to tribunal. She had to fund it all herself. I think it cost her $15,000 in the end, which she lost that money. And she won the tribunal, but she was sacked from her job. How is that possible? I do not understand this kind of inequality based around a role. It's unbelievable.
And I hate that the onus is on her in every sense in that, and that the onus is on her to have, well, A, found out about it herself, then B, perhaps she should, you know, there's such a narrative around you should go and ask for a pay rise. Hey, go and do a training on how to negotiate with impact when they're doing exactly the same role. And then she also then has to take on the financial responsibility and risk of proving that she's been treated unfairly in the first place. It's absolutely outrageous. And I particularly find kind of the hiding behind the data very frustrating in terms of making actual change. But exactly as you say, where it's exactly a like-for-like role, it's inexcusable. There was a guy I heard talking on Tuesday. He's from UN Women, I think, and he was saying, actually, no, Kate Bassett said this. She was saying, women are leaning in so far, they're practically horizontal. Why are you trying to change the women? Change the structure. And that resonated with me so much because I think it's brilliant for people to get the training that they need to feel confident, to show up, to talk, to interview well, to negotiate. I think all of those things are brilliant. I also think there's a point at which you need something more structural than networking and coaching and mentoring and training, right? And until those structures change, those crucial numbers aren't going to change. I mean, in the latest Women in the Workplace report, saying that there's a 24% improvement in the representation of women at the C-suite, which is brilliant. And I wonder how much of that was driven by target setting at those businesses, because going back to that point, if you measure it, you treasure it, it seems to be a way of creating change and accountability. But there were also some horrific stories from this event that I went to the other night where people were saying they're the only women on the board, and people come up to them and say, well, it's your responsibility to fix the gender pay gap because you're the only woman, and also the only reason that you're on the board is because you're a woman.
Nice.
Yeah.
We've got work to do. So have you ever experienced or known being paid unequal to your peers, male peers?
Yes. But I don't feel like I can talk about it.
Okay.
On here. From a pay perspective, the conversation stopper is it's determined by an algorithm. There's no manager discretion. How do you have a conversation around that? So it's actually very difficult. You can be as well trained as you want on how to negotiate with impact. Mm. But that's actually a very difficult thing to talk about.
So there can be pay discrepancies based on whatever the algorithm spits out for you, not a role.
The algorithm, being algorithmically determined, is supposed to remove biases from the system.
As long as there was no bias put into the
algorithm. Yeah, of course. Yeah, the goal in that, you know, it might be easy for somebody who looks and sounds like you, who you can relate to want to give them more money, and the way it's determined is meant to take that out.
But does it look at your skill set and then go, this role?
I don't know, and it's the same with, like, I think, like, different cuts of data, and that's what frustrates me a little bit about gender pay gap and, like, differences in reporting in different organisations. It's like, you can see the overarching statistic and feel quite angry about it, and then as soon as someone says, well, no, it's a specific segment at this particular layer, it slightly takes the heat out of it, and you're like, where does that leave me? Because I guess I'm under this age gap, at which point there's parity, so maybe I shouldn't be angry about it anymore. Mm. There's almost that overarching narrative, which I find quite frustrating. Once, you know, analysis is so powerful, it can also unhelpfully take the heat out of an issue that all men and women should be angry about.
Sounds like scaffolding to me. It's something holding up something that's already there. Doesn't sound like it's an analytical way of approaching it. It's just like, well, this line says this, so that makes a distinguishable difference, when actually on the day-to-day running on the floor, it's highly unlikely there's that difference. Yeah. And it takes us back to this gender pay gap, because that's the threat, isn't it? You should be grateful you've got a job, and you should be grateful you're getting this wage. And if you don't like it, go somewhere else.
Yeah, completely. Quite a few conferences that I've been to recently, the World Economic Forum statistic that there won't be global gender equality for another 208 years keeps cropping up. And I wondered how that makes you feel.
I mean, it makes me want to laugh because on one hand, I find that totally believable. So when I spoke at Gather Scotland this year in September, I worked out that 11% of female creative directors was the statistic banded around in May 2018. In May 2019, it reached 12.5%-ish, between 12 and 13, they couldn't pinpoint it. So what I was talking about in that specific role in creative directors, it's going to take at least, at the current rate, 30 years for parity. And that's just focusing on gender. That's not like drilling down into BAME. So 30 years is a generation. It does not surprise me that it's going to take in excess of 200 years to get equality for women. We are going to have some seismic shifts to be able to reach that quicker. And we just look at how slow it is to change things that are in existence. We look at environmental issues. We look at gender issues. We look at race issues. We're talking about things that need huge, rapid, revolutionary change if they're going to change quicker. Laughing, you know, partly because it's heartache, and partly because it's, for me, seems like a reality.
For me, it makes me feel a bit numb because I don't think 208 years is an amount of time that is easily conceptualizable. And I think especially when it's on a global scale, don't want to be too inward looking, but when you think about what can you influence, what can you change, when you think about that period of time globally, it makes it feel slightly, it makes me despair slightly and also kind of towards inaction rather than thinking about what can be done, how can we get that number up over a shorter period of time. But I go back to the earlier point, which is what are the structural changes that need to be made and why aren't they being made? Because I'm happily and heartily full of the brilliant training and support that is available for people, but I really want to see some drastic rules broken within corporations to change the underlying structures in government, in corporations, in everywhere. And I don't see that being done, which is just making me feel a little bit like this is all a little bit futile. And it makes me feel sad.
But I believe we can do it. I believe we can make the change and that we are the change. And I just, we've got to keep focusing on it. It doesn't feel futile to me, whatever. I just know that I need to do something and I'm just going to focus on doing what I can, and that is going to contribute. And if we can all do that bit, no matter how small, that is going to speed up the process.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't think I meant it's futile to act. It's not futile to take action or try to drive change. But I think often that is the power is in the individual to make that change, right? Because if lots of individuals feel that way, men and women, then that will be the bottoms up approach to changing those structures rather than waiting for those structures to change themselves. And I think what you're seeing at the moment with Extinction Rebellion and a lot of the way change is happening and like the contagion impact of small uprisings of school children, of people taking individual agency and making that change through their choices is really inspiring. And something that our global head of people operations, Eileen Norton, has always said, which is the best way to kind of create change and grow your career is to do great work. And I really believe that. I think you can, there's so much stuff, but also just fucking nail your work and become an amazing contributor. And I just think that's also a really helpful and achievable principle. You know, in a world where there's so many things that you can spend your time doing, back to my earlier point, if all you're doing is being an absolute badass at work, keep doing that, because that will also, you're a leader, be a leader in what you're doing, and that's also another way to create change.
I couldn't agree more, and I think that's a gorgeous note to end on. Be a badass at work, be a badass at what you're doing. And I'm super excited about the coming month. I shall be interviewing a DJ.
Interesting.
I will be interviewing also a foodie and a founder of a very creative food, which I'm very excited about. And I'll also be doing an anti-podcast, our first of series two, which I'm very excited about, with an illustrator and art director. So heaps to talk about for our next get together.
Amazing. And would love to get some input from our wonderful listeners on the weird and wonderful things from the creative industry that you see that you would like to send in and for us to discuss.
Awesome. Thanks, Crystal.
Thank you, Renee.